This is the voice of the Trumpet Magazine. News, economy, politics, trends, discovery, health, family, the Bible, the future. This is Trumpet Hour.
Welcome, and thank you very much for listening today. I'm Joel Hilliker. All the news everywhere is about coronavirus these days, but today's Trumpet Hour, we're going to take a break from all of that. We're going to give you the non-coronavirus edition of the Trumpet Hour today. We have an inspiring story about an awesome scientific accomplishment. 30 years ago next month, April 24th, 1990, the Hubble Space Telescope was released into low Earth orbit. We'll hear a report from Trumpet writer Jeremiah Jacques about the history of this telescope and why it's been such an invaluable tool for us in coming to better understand the universe. After that, we'll have a conversation with holistic nutritionist Jörg Mardian about diet soda. A lot of people seem to think this is a great way to enjoy the pleasures of cola without the consequences, that it can even be a way to lose weight. Well, if you have bought into this thinking, if you've drunk that down, you'll want to hear this conversation. You need to understand the truth and know what this product is doing to your health. I'll conclude the program today with some words about why at times it's important to deprive your children, maybe something that is very practical as you're dealing with lockdown and kids at home that aren't normally at home. We'll start, though, with some political news out of Israel. In the election earlier this month, it looked like Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu was in great shape to form a strong government, a much better result than the two elections prior, which took place just over this past year. But things have taken an ugly turn. To better understand what is going on here and what may happen next, we have via Skype from our office in Jerusalem, Trumpet writer Brent Noctegal. Hello, Brent.
Hello.
So we talked about this on the Week in Review program last Friday with Warren, but if you could just quickly catch us up to speed with this unprecedented political situation we see in Israel.
It's hard to just catch you up to speed because there is just so much that is going on in Israel right now behind the scenes and in broad daylight as well in an attempt to subvert the previous election that took place on March 2nd. You'll remember that Netanyahu came out in the early hours of March 3rd with his wife celebrating the victory, the greatest victory Likud has ever had in an election. They won 37 seats, their greatest number of seats they've ever got. And he was excited about the potential of receiving the mandate from the president, Reuven Rivlin, to then form a coalition, to gather as many parties together as to form the 61-seat majority that he would have in the Knesset to then be prime minister again for a number of years. And that's what we thought would happen. Well, it turns out that Netanyahu could only receive 58 seats with his coalition partners. He was not able to wrangle enough people from blue and white to join his party. And so he didn't form the coalition, but he was still in a better position than Benny Gantz, who only received 33 seats, his blue and white party. And together with the stated coalition partners of Benny Gantz, Avigdor Lieberman, he received, I think, 6 or 7 seats. And then he had the parties on the left. I think they had about 6 seats as well. He only had 48 compared to Netanyahu's 58. And so, again, it still looked good for Netanyahu. Of course, I'm not accounting for an extra 15 seats that exist in the Knesset, and they belong to the joint list. This is a group of 4 Arab parties that have come together over the past few elections to form one Arab bloc inside the Knesset. This is a party that is basically anathema to both blue and white and the left and a lot of other parties, because they don't believe in the right of Israel to be the Jewish state. They want to remove that status. They just want it to be a straight up democratic state. And prior to the election, Benny Gantz said time and time and time again, as did all his cohorts, that they would not form a coalition with the Arab parties, the joint list. And so what happened, though, a couple of days after the election, is that they said that they would form a temporary arrangement with the joint list, who got 15 seats in the election. And together with Benny Gantz, with his coalition, they received about 61. So they could get to the majority with the Arab list. And so Reuven Rivlin then, seeing this, awarded Benny Gantz the opportunity to see if he could solidify such a coalition. Now, it turns out that Benny Gantz has no intention of going forward with a huge coalition for the next 3 years as prime minister with the Arab List, with a joint list. They wouldn't like it, and a lot of blue and white supporters wouldn't like it as well, because you're siding with somebody that essentially is siding with terrorists. So what he is planning to do in this period of 4 to 6 weeks that he has to try and form a coalition, he is trying to push through two bills or two laws through the Knesset. The Knesset was sworn in a couple of days ago. The Prime Minister had disbanded the Knesset because of the coronavirus. The Supreme Court said, no, you can't do that. And so they went back and they swore everybody in. And so now, in this window of time when there's a caretaker government, he's trying to push forward these two laws. These two laws are, one, effectively limiting the Prime Minister to two terms, which would effectively negate Netanyahu from serving ever again, and also creating another law that if you are indicted, under indictment, you cannot be prime minister. Israel's current law says that you can be prime minister under indictment until that is proven against you. So what he's effectively doing is using this window of opportunity that is meant for coalition building to actually ram through laws with his anti-Netanyahu cabal, including the joint list that makes up 61 seats, to try and then remove the other candidate from the opportunity to be prime minister, the one that got the most votes, the one that 48% of Israel's population voted for to be prime minister. He's effectively trying to create laws to remove him from having the opportunity to be the prime minister of Israel.
This seems like an extraordinarily dangerous political move for Gantz, considering how much support Netanyahu received in this last election. He's playing a pretty dicey political game here.
It is, and it's one that a lot of people are drawing attention to, the fact that his voters, the people that voted for blue and white, wouldn't be for this move. They are definitely, all of them are anti-Netanyahu. That's why they all voted for him. And that was their number one policy of the blue and white party. We don't like Netanyahu. We want him gone. He's been in power too long. And that's how they garnered whatever it was, 25% of the vote or 30% or just under that. And so that part of it they like, Israelis would like, but the fact that they're going to side with the Arabs, the joint list, an openly hostile group. I mean, a couple of these leaders inside this joint list, one of them, you know, is the former advisor to Yasser Arafat, and so he was around there at the first and second intifada. One of them has ties to the Muslim Brotherhood and Qatar, and others, all of them again believe in the right of return. This is where the Palestinians that were exiled or expelled, let's say in 48, in the War of Independence, get to come back and flood Israel with 6 million or 5 million Palestinians. They disagree with the law of return, which is the fundamental right that was enshrined in the foundational document of Israel, that Jews everywhere around the world can come and live in Israel to escape the violence that has gone after the Jewish people throughout history. There's a law there that says if you're Jewish, you can live in Israel. And the joint list wants to get rid of that law and says it's undemocratic for the rest of the state of Israel. And so they want to fundamentally change the nature of the state of Israel. And a lot of blue and white voters are not happy that Benny Gantz has decided to join up with them, even if it is to get rid of Netanyahu. And I think that's rightfully so, to partner with an anti-Zionist group over one of even if you don't like the personality, somebody that believes in the viability and future of the Jewish state. It seems pretty far out there for Gantz to do this.
Right. This is you would think the kind of cynicism and opportunism on the part of Gantz that a lot of Israelis would find beyond the pale.
Yes, but it's really hard. It's really hard to know that, because in Israel you have such a left-wing media. It's owned and operated by the left-wing, Haaretz, Jerusalem Post these days. You've got to go to some difficult. Like on radio or television, you're not going to find any ProNet and Yahoo source out there on radio or television. You've got the Israel Hayom, which is Israel's largest read daily, just because it's offered for free. That's the only reason, and it's everywhere on the streets. They are supportive of Netanyahu, but it's hard to know what the people want until you have a vote. You have a vote and it comes out and Netanyahu wins the support of half the people in the country, listening to the media, you would be shocked by that was even possible. And so it's hard to get a feel for the people's will unless you have a vote, which, again, is something I'm bringing out in my piece, is the fundamental rule of democracy is that the people should choose the leaders. And here you had half the country come out and pick him, and yet – in some type of after the election, the candidate that you thought was going to be prime minister is then disqualified by the other side. Mm-hmm. It betrays the democratic values of Israel for sure. And I think it is so obvious that people are going to see it. What is the alternative? What if Gantz can't pull this off? What if he can't end up getting the 61 members of the Knesset to vote through these laws, which is probably highly likely that he can't actually do it?
Yeah, he would have even some within his own party who would defect.
Yeah, I mean, everyone has got to be thinking about their own political future here inside Blue and White. Blue and White is an amalgamation of three or four parties, and it just came together to try and defeat Netanyahu. And so you've got elements inside his party that belong to the right wing that definitely don't want to side with the Arabs in this instance. And so they've got to be thinking about their political future. And so it doesn't look like – I don't think this is actually going to go through – in the end, but what it will do and what it has done is it has exposed Blue and White to the public at how far they are willing to get rid of Netanyahu, mm-hmm. further than their voters would have gone for sure. And if it gets to a fourth election, which seems like that is, let's say, 50-50, that it's going to a fourth election now, I think this would be the end of the Blue and White Party, or close to the end of the Blue and White Party. You would probably see some fragmentation take place within that party, so that the people that voted for it to get rid of Netanyahu but not willing to compromise on the Arab point can vote for another party. So it is hard to know where it's going right now, but I think – if people that are listening to this, and most of them are not that familiar with Israeli politics, it can be likened to what we've seen in the United States, this effort after effort after effort to remove the people's choice for president. And people are understandably upset by this. Something similar to that is definitely taking place in Israel. And it's my hunch that Netanyahu is going to come out of this stronger in potentially a fourth election, or maybe some type of unity government with Benny Gantz eventually, where he is still remaining prime minister.
You mentioned the parallels with the United States, what's happening in the United States right now. You definitely see that within a certain element of the political class, but you also see this alliance with the media that is very much against the incumbent. And they're willing to spin the news of the day against him in any way that they possibly can. You're seeing that a lot within those sources that you described.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, you know, you read a story each day about democracy dying in Israel, and just reading the headline and watching what's going on, you would think it's about what I've explained, but it's not. The article is about how Netanyahu has been in power for so long. He destroys his political enemies. He's indicted, and he should step down because, look, he's guilty of treason and bribery and all these other things. Why isn't he stepping down? We're going into a dictatorship, when really the opposite is true. And so, as you said, the media is all on board.
Justifies the means, like they're in their view. I mean, they'll use the term like democracy so long as it suits their agenda. They'll talk about freedom as long as it suits their agenda. But what they're interested in is a particular political outcome, whatever it takes to achieve it.
Right. The Supreme Court of Israel just handed down a ruling yesterday And this was because the Speaker of the Knesset, who's a Netanyahu ally, said he didn't want to go forward with this vote. And so here you've got blue and white saying, OK, well, we have to replace the Speaker of the Knesset because he's in charge of bringing the bills to the Knesset floor. And so let's get our own guy in there to do that since we have majority. We've got 61 seats in the Knesset. He says, no, I'm not going to let you vote to remove me. So the Supreme Court weighs in and says, yes, you have to do it. You have to let them vote. The Knesset is sovereign, is what the Supreme Court said. In this case, they're all for the Knesset to be sovereign over Israel. Yet when it comes to the indictment against the prime minister, when it comes to a lot of other laws that they've struck down from the Knesset, their actions prove that they want to be sovereign. And mm-hmm. so in this case, when it serves the Supreme Court, which is far on the left, when it serves the media, when it serves the left-wing political class, yes, the Knesset is sovereign. And yes, they're willing to go along with the Constitution at that point. But as you said, the end definitely justifies the means. And we're seeing this play out amongst the left here in Israel.
You said that you felt like it's a 50-50 proposition whether there's another election in Israel. What's the other 50? What happens that would prevent an election from taking place?
Well, I guess it's 50-25-25. The two other options is Benny Gantz makes it through with the 61 and he passes these two laws and Netanyahu's gone from the scene. It's hard to see that happening, but that is an option. The other option is that at some point Benny Gantz is using this as some type of leverage on Netanyahu to try and bring him into a unity government whereby blue and white and Likud, Netanyahu's party, actually come together under blue and white being the under Benny Gantz being the prime minister. He might be trying to force his hand at that to try and get Likud to succumb to what he desires there. Keeping, that would mean Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu in the Knesset, but not as the prime minister. So they're the other two options. But I think increasingly, it looks like Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu will retain in power in a unity government being the prime minister, or Israel is going to a fourth election, at which point the cover is blown for blue and white.
Right.
Israel knows they'll side with the Arabs. And at that point, Netanyahu would probably receive a far greater mandate to rule Israel.
All right. You heard it here on Trumpet Hour from Brent Noctegal. Netanyahu going to grow in power. That's where we're putting our bets. We don't bet, but that's what we're thinking.
that's where I think it's going.
We've been talking with trumpet writer Brent Noctegal about this remarkably chaotic situation in Israeli politics. He wrote a trumpet brief yesterday about this subject. You can find that now on the front page of thetrumpet.com. And if you're not a Trumpet Brief subscriber, I encourage you to take advantage of this free service we provide. It's an email each day with a message from one of our writers, including our editor-in-chief. He writes for those occasionally. You can go to the front page of thetrumpet.com. There's a little box a little ways down the page, and you can subscribe for free. Thank you very much, Brent. Appreciate that.
No problem.
This is the voice of the Trumpet News Magazine. You're listening to Trumpet Hour.
30 years ago, next month, a remarkable scientific tool was deployed out past Earth's atmosphere, a tool that has utterly transformed our understanding of the universe we inhabit. We'll learn all about it in this report from Jeremiah Jacques.
Back in the year 1610, the Italian polymath Galileo Galilei took a telescope, which was technology that had just been invented a few months earlier, and he pointed it at Saturn. And here's what he wrote in his journal that night. To my very great amazement, Saturn was seen to me to be not a single star, but three together, which almost touch each other. By pointing this new technology toward the night sky, Galileo and other astronomers were suddenly able to see far more of the universe's detail than mankind had been able to for millennia. But as shown by Galileo's error, mistaking Saturn's rings for pairs of tightly orbiting moons, their window into the cosmos was still foggy. It was still obscure. This obscurity was caused by something that is vital for life on Earth, but a serious hindrance for stargazers. And that is Earth's atmosphere. The atmosphere accomplishes several crucial things for life on Earth. It provides oxygen-rich air to breathe. It gives protection from both solar radiation and objects coming toward Earth. And it also retains heat to keep the planet from becoming a frozen wasteland. Without the haze of gases that is the atmosphere, life on Earth would be impossible. But when light passes through the atmosphere, some wavelengths are entirely absorbed by it, and others are shifted and distorted. This is what makes stars have the appearance of twinkling, and it makes the view of the cosmos blurry for anyone looking up from Earth's surface. In his book, The Universe in a Mirror, Robert Zimmerman writes, quote, "Trapped on the Earth within its unsteady and hazy atmosphere, astronomers were condemned to look at the heavens as though they had bad vision and were forbidden from using glasses." So that's why even with a telescope, Galileo couldn't see clearly. And even as telescope technology greatly improved from Galileo's time on into the 1900s, what astronomers could see and photograph of the heavens remained fuzzy and revealed little detail. Some astronomers, as early as the 1920s, saw how beneficial it would be to place a telescope in orbit, where it would float up above the atmosphere and be able to capture clear images. But for decades, this was only a dream for the starry-eyed. Then in 1946, as rocket technology was taking off, the American astronomer Lyman Spitzer wrote an article detailing exactly how a telescope could be put into orbit. And he said such a telescope would uncover new phenomena not yet imagined and revolutionize our view of the cosmos. Spitzer's article didn't make any real impression on other scientists at the time, but it left a crater-deep impact on his own mind. And from 1946 on, he devoted himself almost entirely to turning this idea on paper into a giant Earth-orbiting telescope. He blasted through expanses of data, he puzzled out myriad technical problems, and he tried to convince others of the idea's merit. And in 1966, at the height of the space race, Spitzer was appointed by the National Academy of Sciences to turn his vision into a reality. This appointment was a victory, but the project's greatest hurdles still lay ahead. The engineering challenge was enormous. Astronomy skeptics and political skeptics abounded, and funding was repeatedly delayed. A target launch in 1979 slipped by. Then another one in 1983 hurtled past. That year, the project was renamed the Hubble Space Telescope. And starting around then, work on the project shifted into high gear. Teams of technicians from Lockheed, PerkinElmer, the Wide Field Planetary Camera Team, NASA's Goddard Space Flight Center, and the Space Telescope Science Institute all worked under the supervision of Marshall Space Flight Center. In 1986, technicians from the various crews were piecing their numerous components together, and a launch by the end of the year seemed on target. Astronomers were over the moon. But on January 28th, NASA suffered one of the darkest tragedies in its history. The Space Shuttle Challenger disintegrated during launch, killing all seven of its crew.
We have a report from the flight dynamics officer that the vehicle has exploded. Flight director confirms that. We are looking at checking with the recovery forces to see what can be done at this point.
All shuttles were grounded, and Hubble was boxed up and put into storage. It wasn't until 3 years later that Hubble was unpacked and shipped to the Kennedy Space Station in Florida. And then, finally, on April 24th of 1990, nearly 45 years after Spitzer had made a case for a space telescope and started laboring on it, Hubble was launched. The 43-foot-long telescope was released into low Earth orbit, about 350 miles above the surface and well above the distortion of Earth's atmosphere. That was 30 years ago next month. There were some major corrections that astronauts had to make to Hubble's mirrors to make it see clearly, but those corrections were successful. And then, at last, after millennia of viewing the heavens through a haze, mankind was able to behold it through a perfect prescription lens. And what it has shown us is absolutely staggering.
The Hubble telescope has sent back some of the most moving, stirring, exciting pictures you've ever seen in your life, or any men have ever seen, because there have never been any like it before on this planet.
That's Trumpet Editor-in-Chief Gerald Fleury from an episode of his show, The Key of David, that was first broadcast on January 18th, 2013. And he's exactly right about how moving and stirring the images from Hubble have been, and about the unprecedented clarity that they've given us about the universe. Hubble has captured remote supernovas, which showed us that the universe's expansion is not slowing, but accelerating. It's also shined light on the mysteries of dark energy and dark matter. It's given us unprecedented insight into exoplanets and has revealed the ubiquity of black holes, showing that almost all large galaxies center around one. And Hubble's intense and prolonged gaze at what are called deep fields have shown us that even parts of the firmament that we thought were dark and empty are actually radiant with galaxies. Hubble has let us peer at the early eons of the cosmos, allowing astronomers to pin down the universe's age. In the 30 years since its launch, Hubble has taken hundreds of thousands of the most breathtaking photos ever captured, stars being born, galaxies entering their adolescent years, supernovas dying, nebula of size incomprehensible, galaxies of hues uncategorizable, and celestial bodies so far away our brains can't begin to fathom the distance. Robert Zimmerman enumerates all these stunning discoveries and then writes, quote, "Hubble and the men and women behind it opened a rare window into the universe, dazzling humanity with sights never before seen." In Mr. Fleury's Key of David episode, he said that there's an aspect of Hubble's discoveries that is even more important. And we can get a glimpse of this by going back to long before Lyman Spitzer or even Galileo. When King David looked at the heavens some 3,000 years ago, he saw them only with the naked eye. Yet he gaped breathlessly at God's creation and was particularly fascinated by mankind's place within it. In Psalm 8, 3-4, David said to God, "When I consider your heavens, the work of your fingers, the moon and the stars which you have ordained, what is man that you are mindful of him?" Later in the psalm, David said, "The same God who created the radiant cosmos also made human beings to have dominion over his creation on earth." The Apostle Paul, about 1,000 years after David, quoted part of that psalm and brought additional meaning to it. In Hebrews 2, Paul makes clear that God will not give mankind control just over the earth, but will put everything in subjection under him, the whole universe. Everything Hubble has shown us, from the four moons it discovered around Pluto, right here in our own solar system, to the most unfathomably remote galaxy, it'll all be under mankind's control. That's a foundational message declared in numerous scriptures, and Hubble's images could be seen as the companion photos that could be printed alongside those verses. Here's Mr. Fleury once again.
It's about your potential if you understand what the Bible is teaching. It's about your potential. Why all of that vast universe anyhow? Well, God wants us to know, why are we here? What God has for us to see with our eyes, ought to just set our imaginations on fire. It is that soul-stirring. It is that wonderful. That cosmos out there is there, if we understand it the way the Bible teaches it, so that we can get to know God. It's a major way that we get to know God and know about our own future. That's something we need to look into very carefully.
Mr. Fleury goes on in that very powerful episode to say that God had a hand in the Hubble telescope. He helped to make this starry-eyed dream become a reality 30 years ago next month, so that all of us on Earth could have a clear look, a rare window opened up for us to see man's out-of-this-world future.
Thank you very much for that, Jeremiah. It is inspiring to look back on that history and this amazing scientific accomplishment. I remember Mr. Fleury talking about this. It was a commencement address probably 10 years ago or so, where he was talking about the origins of this telescope and the fact that this was launched really at the same time that the Philadelphia Church of God was. And just drawing attention to the fact that, to him, he said he felt like you mentioned, that God had a hand in it, and it was particularly for this age right now.
Yes, I think that's a really important aspect of this. That was actually a May 2009 commencement address. I graduated from Herbert W. Armstrong College at that time, and just remember that address being very impacting. He did focus a lot on Hubble, and especially just the fact that the PCG, the Philadelphia Church of God, that God raised up, was launched in January of 1990. And then just a couple of months later, April 1990, you had this launch of the Hubble Space Telescope. And Mr. Fleury just called a lot of attention to the fact that he felt that God had a hand in it, because as people in the church saw, problems with the Worldwide Church of God and a lot of people abandoning the truth, to sort of offset that, God simultaneously gave us this window into the heavens, into the future of mankind. Very compelling address there. And it's actually online, that address is. It was later made into a Keith David episode.
Mm. So it seems like the word that NASA has actually created a telescope that will succeed and supersede Hubble has been in the works for a long time. And still to this point, Hubble is kind of the only game in town, isn't it?
Yeah, that's right. Hubble is already functioning long past when it was thought to expire, sort of, partly just because it's well made and they've been able to do many repairs and even upgrades and improvements over the years, and partly because its successor, the James Webb Space Telescope, has been delayed over and over again. I'm really excited to see that one finally go online. I believe 2009 was the original launch target.
Wow.
But that's been put off over and over again. Right now they're saying early 2021, I believe. So could be right around the corner, and it seems like it's going to clarify our view that much more. It's more powerful mirrors, more powerful machinery of all kinds. So I'm very excited to see what that shows us.
We will look forward to that. So we've been talking with trumpet writer Jeremiah Jacques about the Hubble Space Telescope. He wrote an article that was published in the April 2020 Trumpet print edition. The title of that is Opening a Rare Window into the Heavens. Go check that out. You can find that at thetrumpet.com under magazine, and it gives the latest issue of The Trumpet. Thank you so much, Jeremiah.
It's a pleasure to be here.
This is Trumpet Hour with Joel Hilliker.
Diet soda. It is a guilt-free drink, no fat, calories, or carbohydrates, right? Well, you're still drinking sugars. They're just artificial. And studies find links between these artificially sweetened beverages and many severe health problems. To talk about this, we have via Skype from his office in British Columbia, holistic nutritionist Jörg Mardian. Hello, Jörg.
Hello.
So, diet soda, a lot of people drink it to help lose weight. Is that a good strategy?
Well, they do it, but it's not a good strategy. There's a lot of sweetness in that can. And like you said, in the opening, there's no calories. And it just seems like a really, really good deal. I mean, I can drink unlimited amounts. I'm going to lose weight, except it's a con. Well, the average can of sugar-sweetened soda, the normal, regular soda, has about 150 calories. So if you compare it to this, the same amount of diet soda has zero calories. So it almost seems too good to be true there, right? But no calories doesn't mean no worries. So artificial sweeteners, they're the key to the diet claim, but there's a massive amount of new research that shows we should be wary of the results that are coming up now. So if we look at the studies, you're going to hear a lot about diet soda being, you know, it's association, but not necessarily causation. So they're observational studies, meaning it might not necessarily just be the soda. But it's interesting that when we examine the timeline of artificial sweetener use and obesity trends in the United States, there's almost a parallel rise. So that, you know, when they were introduced from the 1960s on, you can see the rise in obesity in America, almost rising in parallel with it. Now, what type of foods usually contain sweeteners? Well, you know, diet soft drinks, baked goods, fruit juices, with labeled as diet or reduced sugar. So these aren't what we would call wholesome foods. Mm-hmm. So you get a food, it's a trickery, because you get a food that really isn't a proper food, and then you say, well, we'll make a diet and it'll become a proper food. It's not. Mm-hmm. So now, because these type of artificial sweeteners, they're about 200 to 600 times as sweet as sugar.
Wow.
So when you pop in that can and you get that incredible fizzy taste and your tongue just goes, wow, you know, this is sweet. And I can keep drinking this because it tastes so good. And you're going to want to keep drinking it. But, you know, the thing is, the way that it interacts with the gut bacteria is that it makes you want sweet food more. So you can have, let's say you have a habit of 4 cans a day, you know, that's gonna want your body to seek out more sweet food. It's really tricking the mind. So how much you can gain is actually pretty shocking. I had to look hard for this because a lot of studies, you know, they're not as tight as you'd like them to be, but there's a 10-year study from the University of Texas Health Science Center. And I was shocked. You know, your waistline can enlarge by up to 500% over time with diet soda.
Wow.
So that's pretty radical. So yes, they don't know for sure if it's just the diet soda, or is the diet soda making you eat more junk food, or are you eating junk food and you're just substituting diet soda with it? Mm-hmm. All I know is I see a lot of people say, well, I'll have that burger because I'm having a diet soda.
Right. Yeah.
It doesn't make up for it.
So you said something about the bacteria in the gut and the way that it interacts with the diet soda. Could you elaborate on that? I'm not quite sure that I caught what you said there. How does diet soda affect gut health?
Well, it actually changes the bacteria in the gut. You know, it's right at the DNA level. So the way that it does, there's what we call a gut-brain connection. So a lot of the serotonin that are produced in the gut, that means your gut is lined with hundreds of or millions of nerve cells and neurons, right? So, and the production of serotonin, it's influenced by our gut bacteria. So they activate these pathways that travel right between the gut and the brain.
And what does serotonin do?
Just to feel good. These are feel-good chemicals. So when you do something, you have these pleasure centers. Mm-hmm. So serotonin, it just gives you that really feel-good. You say, wow, I feel really great at the moment. Like, say, if you eat something with sugar, you're going to activate that. But that's the wrong way to do it. Mm-hmm. You know, we can put that into overdrive and in a wrong way. But if we eat wholesome foods, then we feel good in a natural way. It's kind of like being junked up on caffeine all day or doing it, you know, in a proper way about how to feel good. So when the balance of that gut bacteria is disrupted by a poison like diet soda, you know, we actually start to get brain issues. So these artificial sweeteners, they change brain activity, and that has to do with our gut, with eating sweet foods as well. So sucralose, for example, compared to regular sugar, decreases activity in the part of the brain that regulates taste. So And it's also linked to the region that gives you a feeling of satisfaction. So that's where that serotonin would come in as well. So artificial sweeteners, again, they're so sweet that you can overkill the taste buds. Like we just don't have a proper taste anymore. So you get less pleasure from the sweetness. And, you know, that means you could, this is a theory, that you would consume more. So that might explain why a lot of people who consume these artificial sweeteners have a higher risk of obesity. Mm-hmm. I mean, there's a strong link to it. It's observational, but it keeps popping up. And so in 2017, they had a review of all the human and animal data on aspartame. And they said that even at a safe dosage, it may prove to be a systemic inflammatory neurotoxic that impairs learning and memory. And it causes migraines and headaches and depression, even is linked to Parkinson's and brain tumors. And wow, that really has to do with you chugging that soda, disrupting your billions of gut bacteria, and that is now linked to brain health.
Unbelievable. So, well, that's a whole lot of problems associated with diet soda. Are there other health risks involved?
Well, unfortunately, there are. I wish I could say there's less, but there's a host of life-altering health conditions. There's a large study, a nurse's health study, and a health professional's follow-up study. They were quite large, and they reported there's more risk of type 2 diabetes from these drinks, high blood pressure, heart disease, metabolic syndrome, and that's a big one because it's related to diabetes and cardiovascular problems. And you know what I find odd about this, though, is that artificial sweeteners are supposed to prevent all this because they're not sugars. Mm-hmm. So we find all of these problems with regular sugar, and here we're putting it on hyperdrive because our brain doesn't really recognize this as a regular food because it has no calories. Right. Mm-hmm. So we get, our body starts doing very odd things with a food that has no calories. The brain is expecting calories and it's not getting it. So you're disrupting all these pathways in the body. Now, what you've got in there, I don't know if, you know, anybody ever reads the ingredients, but you've basically got artificial sweeteners, colors, flavors. You've got food additives and they're all floating around in carbonated water. Mm-hmm. So it, to me, it's little wonder that the body rebels because some of these chemicals are found in like rust remover, steel cleaner, cement, you know, in tiny quantities, of course. I don't want to say they're in big quantities, but if you're consuming a lot of soda, if you have a high consumption, that's been linked to DNA damage. I mean, right down to the DNA, hyperactivity, early kidney disease, bone fractures, you know. Mm.
Like it makes the bones more brittle.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
You know, and experts keep, every time I dig into this, experts say, we just want to say it's not a direct cause because we don't know it's a direct cause. Mm-hmm. But if I'm hanging around with a bunch of bank robbers and I'm constantly in the same place as they are, there's a strong, I'm going to become a suspect really quickly, right? I'm always around the same bunch of robbers that get caught.
Yeah.
But so, these are really, these drinks are a fuse that sets chronic diseases aflame. That's what I see from the studies because they're always associated with disease. There's nothing to me that would suggest that you should consume these even in moderation, mm-hmm. as some experts would say. And I'll tell you why, because unhealthy food is associated with 1 in 5 deaths worldwide.
Wow.
So that's a huge statistics. And these drinks aren't exactly health elixirs. You know, like I said, they're just a bunch of chemicals floating in fake sugars, and they're going to tear down your health.
Mm-hmm. And well, it seems like the moral of the story for a lot of the conversations we have comes down to don't trust food manufacturers when they're producing these foods and beverages in labs, and science is basically putting these things together, that if that's where you're getting your sustenance, then you're going to end up having problems. That so much of this comes down to just staying away from the highly processed products and going toward whole foods. When it comes to drinks. We haven't talked a whole lot about just what we drink, but what are your recommendations for, apart from just staying away from diet sodas, any alternatives that people can take for better choices?
Oh, sure there are. I mean, one of the best things that you can drink is just pure mineral water, alkaline water. I mean, mineral water, just normal mineral water, not reverse osmosis or anything like that, is just slightly alkaline. That's best for us. Herbal tea is really good. I drink a lot of herbal tea. Lemonade water is good. A lot of people may find that a tart taste, but to me, I find in the mornings, it wakes you up really nicely. And
squeezing a lemon into some water?
Yes.
Yeah.
I mean, to me, I've even found that, you know, after a hard day of work, I used to be in landscaping and I could barely move because the sun would just beat you down. Mm-hmm. And then you try to go to gym and you didn't have energy. But I found if I just put some, a lemon, half an orange and a little bit of sea salt in water, it just gave me back my energy. Mm. You know, that's just like a natural Gatorade. Mm-hmm. So, and if people do want some coffee, I mean, you know, have some organic coffee. It's going to be better than diet soda. Just like I said, everything should be in moderation when we consume it. Even the occasional glass of red wine has positive properties, you know. Mm-hmm. But again, we should be on the occasional, not over consuming it. Mm-hmm. But nothing positive comes out of soda. And that shouldn't be surprising because nothing good goes into it. You know, our body becomes damaged if we ingest anything other than a premium fuel, food or water. I would never call a soda a premium fuel, ever. So I would say ditch any low premium substance that you're using right now, such as diet soda, and just put that good stuff in your body, and then you can enjoy a richer life through better health.
I've heard that the quantities of sugar in any kind of a cola or soda are just astronomical compared to just about anything else that you might put in your mouth, that it's very easy to consume far more sugar than you are expecting. Even like iced teas or those types of products can have a whole lot of sugar in it, or even processed fruit juices. It seems like staying away from those kinds of beverages, if someone is drinking a whole lot of that type of product, that just getting away from that one step can be a huge step toward much improved health.
Well, that's exactly it. And what you're leaning towards there, what we're talking about, these are processed foods again, or drinks. You know, and it's very easy to walk in a store and say, I'm thirsty and I'm going to grab something. And when you watch people, they never read a label. But if you're not reading a label, you're not getting an understanding of how much sugar is in there. You know, and sugar really leads to cancer. I mean, it just starves the body of oxygen. So any of these drinks you're talking about, even fruit juices, I hear a lot of mothers say, well, Mike, you know, I give my child fruit juices. I wouldn't give a lot of those, you know, in moderation perhaps, but if you drink a glass of orange juice, I mean, you've just squeezed how many oranges in there? Mm-hmm. You would never consume those naturally. These waters that are coming out, mineral waters, watch them. You have no idea what's in them. I mean, I saw one child, I looked at the drink, I never seen it, I said, let me see, and I looked in the back and it had over 60 grams of sugar. Mm-hmm. I've never seen that in my life. Now, that child is going to have a lot of energy for the next, you know, 25 minutes.
Right.
So, yep. But after that, you're going to see a crash. So, again, we're talking about do stuff that's traditional. Water is still very good. And by the way, people don't drink enough water either. Water helps your bones. We were talking about bone health. Mm-hmm. You know, the bone won't actually remineralize properly without water. Mm-hmm. So we're putting all these other substances in it, but we have to have a good amount of water, especially as we age, so that our bones stay strong in conjunction with good diet and exercise.
Mm-hmm. Marvelous. Thank you very much for that. We've been talking to Jörg Mardian about diet soda and other problematic beverages. He's working on an article about this subject. You can watch for that on thetrumpet.com. Thanks, as always, York. Appreciate that.
It's been a pleasure.
It's time for today's last word.
One of the great things about children is that they naturally stay away from things that are not good for them. Actually, that isn't true at all. But many parents act as though it is true. They let their kids choose their own friends indiscriminately. They give them open access to television, the internet, movies, and music of their own choosing, and so on. And many apparently think that demarking boundaries to young people impairs them, that kids are naturally entitled to all the privileges and freedoms of adulthood. Did you realize that in order to give your children all the good things you want to as a parent, you must deprive them? That's right. Young people need a firm sense of living under the protective umbrella of parental supervision and, dare I say it, control. Rather than receiving everything they desire, they need a comfortable appreciation for the word no. Consider the parenting wisdom contained in Moses' speech to ancient Israel in Deuteronomy 8. There he explained that God had orchestrated their difficult conditions in the desert for a reason. He said, "Who led you through that great and terrible wilderness wherein were fiery serpents and scorpions and drought where there was no water, who brought you forth water out of the rock of flint, who fed you in the wilderness with manna, which your fathers knew not, that he might humble you, that he might prove you to do you good at your latter end." God actually used deprivation as an important teaching tool. Now, obviously, God is a great giver, the source of all good gifts, and we ought to reflect his example in our generosity as parents. However, while God blesses us and encourages us to pursue everything that is good for us, he also outlaws everything that would harm us. And at times, for our benefit, he denies us certain comforts. He even allows us to suffer trials in order to steel our character, to humble us, and to prove us. The Israelites demanded a lot of wrong things, and to educate them as a people, God simply couldn't give them all they wanted. To give our children the right amount of the good things, helping them to see the blessings of the right way of life, yet deprive them of everything that isn't good for them, that requires true leadership in a modern parent. As our children travel a world filled with harmful things, they're going to be naturally attracted to certain of those things, and it takes leadership to tell them they're forbidden to have those things. Yet that's exactly what God does with us. To illustrate this principle, consider one vivid example: technology. Technology is a strong drug. Young people can be particularly susceptible to its evil effects. They have no built-in sense of right and wrong, no natural means of distinguishing something acceptable from something wrong. That's why it's crucial that we as parents authoritatively regulate their media usage, depriving them of wrong influences. Give your children unsupervised access to technology, that's, put bluntly, that's turning them over to some very evil influences. Even an afternoon of children's programming on public television has a lot of shady material, bad attitudes, disrespect for authority, unbridled materialism. A lot of kids' shows have scatological, gross-out humor, feminist or other politically correct messages, even demonism, witchcraft, or other pagan spiritual content. If our children watch this when we're not there, we can't counteract or stop those messages from shaping their thinking. Even the positive lessons that can be learned from certain shows, it's not going to have an impact unless we're there to reinforce those lessons. God is frank. A child left to himself brings his mother to shame. When that proverb, Proverbs 29:15, was recorded, the author couldn't have dreamed of the horrors available to a child left to himself on the internet or other of our modern media. But we as parents must be the gatekeepers of our children's minds as we train them how to be responsible for their own minds. It takes time to teach right from wrong, to help them develop the character to hit the off switch or to walk away from bad influences. So in the meantime, we need to control the off switch. Young people may know how to use a certain technology, but be unaware of the risks it poses. Particularly on the internet, certain activities can unwittingly expose our children to attack from predators. If your child has a personal web page, demand to see it. Know what pictures and music he or she is sharing, what personal information he or she is divulging. Demand that your children share their passwords with you so you can check up on them. This might sound out of date. In our ultra-permissive, anti-authority world, people seem to feel their children and teens are entitled to their privacy. The truth is, we are duty-bound to invade their privacy. We have to do our best to know what our children are watching, listening to, and clicking on. But realize, of course, that our job ultimately, it's not to filter out every bad thing or to ensure that nothing objectionable enters their minds. That's impossible. But more than that, obviously, gawking over their shoulder is pretty awkward when they turn 38 years old. Our job is to teach them gradually how to make these decisions on their own. Give them the tools they need in order to walk away from something even when we're not around. Facilitate any use of technology and media that is genuinely good for our children, that builds right knowledge, cognitive development, character. But in an age of affluence and indulgence, we have to be sensitive to not stoking our children's sense of entitlement. Depriving them of luxuries will not hurt them. And any sense of unfairness or deprivation will be easily coaxed out of them if you never deprive them of the things that truly matter: time, teaching, attention, affection, love. I'm Joel Hilliker, and that'll do it for today's Trumpet Hour. You can send me any thoughts you have on the program today to letters@thetrumpet.com. Thanks to my guests, Brent Noctegal, Jeremiah Jacques, and Jörg Mardian. Thanks to Nick Irwin and Dwight Falk for engineering and production. I'll leave you with this thought from Thomas Jefferson: health is worth more than learning. Thank you for joining us on Trumpet Hour. Until next time, keep watching your world.
Listening to Trumpet Hour on Trumpet Radio, 101.3 KPCG, and online at kpcg.fm. Understand your world.